But anyway, I'm really thrilled to be here. In fact, I used Dan. I don't even know if he still has it. Is it the story of the Bible? Do they still have that? I need to get another copy of that. But I use that, and Dan must be away speaking, I'm guessing. And so I was going to tell him a story, because you don't always get to, you know, hear the fruits of your labor. And when I was in Nashville, there was one couple that started coming. They'd never been to church in their whole lives. And they just started coming. I talked to them about, you know, studying the Bible with them, and they, you know, they're real excited about it. The problem was the times that they worked and trying to get all the, and it was just almost impossible. And so I gave them this, I don't know what you call it, CD-ROM or whatever it was. I said, take this, go back to your computer, look it over for yourself. You know, the only problem was, you know, you had Dan's picture and he's talking the whole time, but you did have other things to look at. But anyway, so you went through that whole thing, and they came back and said, you know, we want to be baptized. And I said, well, that's great. And they were living together at the time, and they even asked me, said, us living together, is that a problem? I said, well, why don't we sit down and talk about it some more? And next thing I know, they are on a flight to Las Vegas, and they get married at the Elvis Chapel. They come back, and they said, we're ready. And we baptized them. So I wanted Dan, hopefully Dan will learn this story later, that, you know, he really promoted a strong marriage. And actually, they're very strong Christians today, even at Riverwood there in Nashville where I served. And I've always loved that couple. But Dan's thing really helped there. Turn over to the book of Judges chapter 13. Judges 13. It's amazing to me how many people that are here have some kind of Hamilton connection. This is a little town of 5,000 folks. You know, and of course there's Betsy, and she used to come in the summers, see her grandparents. Wonderful people. They were such wonderful people. And then met another couple here, and one of the elders at Hamilton even now, and they were good friends of ours, neighbors of ours. They were just a few houses up from us. They had gone to school at Freed Hardeman with them, roomed with them, and then their son roomed with their son at Freed Hardeman. And so how many people are from the state of Alabama? Who is it had the Auburn tag on the front? Was that y'all? I'm so sorry. I saw that, pulled up, said, man, I'm all the way down in West Palm Beach and they got an Auburn tag here. But anyway, I'm an Alabama fan if you can't tell. The topic for tonight is I need thee every hour. And I can't think of a better topic to deal with in this day and time with the economy, the way things have gone, with all the things that we're hearing, you know, in our world, in our nation, and we're very concerned about a lot of things. And that statement within itself, I need thee every hour, is so important for us. In Judges chapter 13, we're going to deal with the first aspect of that, which is I need. And we're dealing with what I refer to as the Bible bodybuilder. It's Samson. Samson was, everything about him was extraordinary, wasn't it? Including his own birth. His mother was barren. She could not have any children. And so God sends an angel of the Lord. In fact, in verse 3 of chapter 13, an angel of the Lord appeared to the woman and he said to her, it is true that you are barren and have no children, but you will conceive and give birth to a son. And then she tells some stipulations. And what really it is a Nazarite vow. This kid is to have a Nazarite vow his whole life, because that's going to be important. Don't let a razor touch his head. Don't give him a haircut. And so there's where the strength, some of the things that God had said about this strength. But the fact of the matter is, it was God who was the strength, right? But we often see this with God. There's got to be a little bit of faith and obedience along with his power. And that's exactly what we find here. And did he have power? Man, did he have power. Now, Samson wasn't always what he was supposed to be with folks. He didn't always keep the Nazarite vow the way it was supposed to have been done. He wasn't always, you know, a good Israelite, follower of God. In fact, the very first thing we learn that Samson says is found in chapter 14, in verse 1. And he basically says there, I want to marry a Philistine. I want to marry a Philistine woman. And his parents, his father, tried to talk him out of this. This is not the way it's supposed to be. You should find you a good Israelite woman. But he said, no, that's the one I want. Go down there and deal with it. And they all go down together. And in that process of going there, they get into the fields of Timnah, the vineyards of Timnah, and this young lion. Now, don't think of a little cub, okay? This was a strong, this was a powerful lion. And it says in verse 5, or actually verse 6, the Spirit of the Lord took control of him. Now, that's important to see. And he tore the lion apart with his bare hands as he might have torn a young goat. I mean, he was awesome. So they go on down. Samson doesn't tell his parents. But they go on down. They're working this deal. And while they're doing this with the parents, 30 Philistine men, they're going to kind of entertain Samson of sorts. And Samson decides to wager with them. I'm going to tell you a riddle, and if you can give me the answer to the riddle in 7 days, I'll give you 30 changes of clothes. Actually, verse 12, the latter part, it says, I'll give you 30 linen garments and 30 changes of clothes. And these were not just common clothes, these were nice. These were expensive clothing he's talking about. But he says, if you can't explain it, then you've got to give that to me. Well, these Philistines, they were a very sophisticated group of people. A lot of times we think of the Philistines, we think in terms of, you know, like barbaric. We think of them as just these, you know, rough groups of folks. They gave the Israelites all kinds of problems, and they were going to continue to do that until David became king. And we'll talk more about that a little bit later. But the backwoods kind of people were the Israelites. They were the ones who were living up in the mountains. The Philistines were a group of people who came down from Greece along the coastline there, and they migrated here. And this is where the culture of the of really that area, and even the world in some sense, was right there with the Philistines. So they were always on them. And God sent Samson into the world. He even said it back in chapter 13 to deal with these Philistines. Well, he does exactly, or the men, those 30 men, they start doing exactly what you would expect. They go to his wife, the deal's been made evidently, and said on day 4, said, look, you got to tell us the answer to the riddle. You got to get it for us. And she goes, and you're going to love this, guys, big crocodile tears, you know. Oh, please, you got to tell me what it is. And Samson basically says, why would I tell you? I haven't even told my own mama or daddy. But it continues on. If you look at verse 17, she wept the whole 7 days of the feast. This is supposed to be a happy occasion. This was supposed to be your big wedding feast. And your bride, she's boohooing the whole time. And it says, and at last on the 7th day, he explained it to her because she had nagged him so much. Then she explained it to the people. And then on the 7th day, they go and explain the riddle to Samson. And guess what Samson does? Now, he shouldn't have done what he did. He shouldn't have been there with those people in the first place. But God is going to use his mistakes and continue to do the work that needed to be done. And in verse 19, we see something familiar. The Spirit of the Lord took control of him. And in the Hebrew, that means rushed upon him. Took control of him, and he went down to Ashkelon, that was a Philistine city, and he killed 30 of their men. He stripped them, he gave them their clothes to those who had explained the riddle, and in a rage, Samson returned to his father's house. He got them their 30 garments, probably all bloodied up from the men that he had killed, Philistines, because he knew what they had done. Now, you would think Samson would write this down in his little book and say, okay, first lesson I learned about Philistine women, you can't always trust them. But for some reason, Samson didn't get that, write that down, you know. This is why they must have put it in stone back in those days, you know. And he needed a stone upside his head, especially when it came down to women. Well, he comes back, and one of the very people in his wedding is the one that her father now has given her to. She's now married to somebody else. He's furious. And so he takes 300 foxes and he ties their tails together, slow burning, you know, candle kind of deal, and runs them off into the grain fields of the Philistines. I mean, this would have been very devastating to this group of people. They weren't very happy about it either. In fact, they went back and they took his wife, or former wife, or whatever you want to call her, burned her and her family. Samson then kind of goes away and hides out into this cave. But he has really stirred up a hornet's nest. Not the Philistines, but there were 3,000 of the tribe of Judah who goes and finds him and says, "Look, man, you are causing us all kind of problems. We're going to die because of you, and we've got to take you in." And they had some new rope, which meant it was strong, and they tied him up. And he said, "Look, as long as you don't kill me, you can hand me just go ahead and hand me over." And they did. And then notice what happened in verse 14. When he came to Lehi, the Philistines came to meet him shouting, "The Spirit of the Lord took control of him." We've heard that before, haven't we? "And the ropes that were on his arms became like burnt flax, and his bonds fell off his wrists. He found a fresh jawbone," which means it was tough, it was virtually unbreakable, "of a donkey. He reached out his hand, he took it, and he killed 1,000 men with it." Samson was powerful. And we know why he was so powerful, because the Spirit of the Lord took control of him. And I think Samson understood that in the beginning, but I think he did exactly the way we do at times. And he began to think, instead of "I need," it was just more about "I." I'm the one doing this. I'm the one that's really strong. Look what he says in verse 16. "Then Samson said, 'With the jawbone of a donkey, I piled them in a heap. With the jawbone of a donkey, I have killed 1,000 men.'" Now, when he really needed something, guess what? He reverts back to the Lord. Because in verse 18, it says he became very thirsty. And he said, called out to the Lord, "You have accomplished this great victory through your servant. Must I now die of thirst and fall into the hands of the uncircumcised?" And God split open a hollow in the ground and water came up. But isn't it interesting? The first time he gave God credit for what had just happened was when he needed something. We don't ever do that, do we? You know, we can think about our talents, we can think about our abilities, what we do, how successful we are, how, you know, and maybe at times we think about God, but really we get to a point where thinking, you know, I am really the one who's in control. And we can get to a point that we're no longer saying "I need," it's more of "I." Until we feel like we need something, and then, "Well, Lord, you know, we give you credit for this. Now listen, let me tell you what I need." And I'll show you why even further that I believe Samson is just going down this slippery slope of the "I" syndrome. Because in verse 16, it says, "Samson went to Gaza, where he saw a prostitute and went to bed with her. When the Gazites heard that Samson was there, they surrounded the place and waited in ambush for him all that night at the city gate." And literally in the Hebrew, it means "in the city gate." Because at these city gates, they had these chambers off to the side. And it was there that they would be laying in wait, waiting for Samson to come out. Samson learned of this. Of course, he shouldn't have been there in the first place. But he goes and he takes the city gates off their hinges. And he carries them down the road about 38 miles. There's no mention of the Spirit of the Lord here. No doubt God has been with him. But he's kind of acting on his own, isn't he? Yeah, it doesn't seem, you know, it's really kind of interesting. And then he meets the one. Remember her name? Delilah. Delilah. Ooh, that's a beautiful name. But unfortunately, it's a Philistine name. And he fell in love with her, is what verse 5 tells us in chapter 16. And so the men of the city, the leaders of the city said, hey, listen, if you can find out his weakness, we'll give you 1,100 pieces of silver apiece. And guess what she does? She goes to work. And I love this in verse 6. So Delilah said to Samson, please tell me, where does your great strength come from? How could someone tie you up and make you helpless? Ding, 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 ding. Red flags everywhere. Samson, what are you missing here? Seems like we kind of went through this before with the riddle. You know, did you get hit in the head somewhere? What is wrong with you, man? Don't tell her. And at first he doesn't. He says, well, you know, if you tie me up with, you know, rope that's never been used, if you tie my 7 braids and put it into a loom, another one, the first one, which was 7 fresh bowstrings that haven't been dried, if you tie me up with those. And all 3 times she calls them in. Here they come. Samson, the Philistines are here. And he gets out of those. And somewhere along those 3, the red flag should have been coming up again, right? Does it? Samson is not very bright. That was not one of the gifts the Lord gave him. Then Delilah, verse 13, said to Samson, you have mocked me all along and told me lies. Tell me how you can be tied up. I'd be asking at this point, well, you know, every time I say something and you, and it just seems like everything's happening and you're the only one I'm telling, but anyway, it says, he told her, if you weave the 7 braids of my... No, I'm going to go on down. Verse 15. How can you say... Oh, this is it. How can you say, I love you, she told him. This is great, ladies. When your heart is not with me, this is the 3rd time you have mocked me and not told me what makes your strength so great. Because she nagged him day after day and pled with him until she wore him out. He told her the whole truth and said to her, my hair has never been cut because a Nazarite, I am a Nazarite to God from birth. If I am shaved, my strength will leave me and I will become weak and be like any other man. Now you should be able to look at me and know I have no strength. Right? But he tells her. And guess what happens? He gets the most famous haircut in the history of the world. All of a sudden, they're rushing on, and listen. Listen to what he says in verse 20. Then she cried, Samson, the Philistines are here. When he woke from his sleep, he said, I will escape as I did before and shake myself free. But he did not know the Lord had left him. And they got him. Now, a lot of times when we get in this I syndrome, the Lord does something for us. He humbles us. When we realize or feel like that we no longer need God, or that we no longer have a real need because we feel that we're all powerful, that's sometimes when he knocks us to our knees. Samson's eyes are torn out. He's now sentenced to grinding grain in the Philistine prison. This guy who had been the superhero, the strongest man ever to have lived. But something happens to a man in prison. It changes him, doesn't it? And so there's going to be this great feast to their god Dagon. And they want to bring him in and let's bring him into this place. And there were like 3,000, over 3,000 or somewhere around in that number people that were there. They're up on these balconies. They're going to bring him in and just kind of make fun of him. They're going to see this great guy who had been a champion. And can you imagine bringing in Osama bin Laden? Catch that man, bring him into a, you know, a big feast that's going on and have him all chained up and people be able to come in, say whatever they want to him, because really, Samson had been a terror to them. They couldn't stop him. But now look at him. But verse 26, Samson said to the young woman who was leading him by the hand, "Lead me where I can feel the pillars supporting the temple, so I can lean against them." The temple was full of men and women. All the leaders of the Philistines were there, and about 3,000 men and women were on the roof watching Samson entertain them. He called out to the Lord. Is there a difference here, what you're hearing? "Lord God, please remember me. Strengthen me, God." I hadn't heard that in a while. "Just once more, with one act of vengeance, let me pay back the Philistines for my two eyes." Samson took hold of the two middle pillars supporting the temple and leaned against them, one on his right and the other on his left. Samson said, "Let me die with the Philistines." He pushed with all his might, and the temple fell on those leaders and all the people in it, and the dead he killed at his death were more than those he killed in his life. I need your strength. I need you, God. And that really leads us to the second point, and that is, I need thee. Turn over to the book of 1 Samuel, chapter 17. People who do not have a Bible, never gone to church in their life, probably know this story. David and Goliath. You hear it used on ESPN. You hear it used in political realms. David defeated Goliath. And so a lot of times we hear David defeated Goliath, but we miss it. Because there was something that David knew that we sometimes forget, and that is he needs God, and that's all he needs. Well, in the beginning part of chapter 17, we see there's a great battle with the Philistines. Shocker. Philistines are powerful. In fact, there in verse 4, we learn that they have a champion. And the word champion literally means a go-between in the Hebrew. Because they would have a champion one side, champion the other side. They'd fight it out. And whoever won, that side won. And so they were a champion. And we notice that Goliath came from Gath. He came out of the Philistine camp. He was 9 feet, 9 inches tall. He wore a bronze helmet, bronze scale armor that weighed 125 pounds. There was bronze armor on his shins and bronze sword that slung between his shoulders. His spear shaft was like a weaver's beam, and the iron point of his spear weighed 15 pounds. In addition, a shield bearer, the Hebrew is a large oblong shield, was walking in front of him. How are you going to get to this guy? Plus the fact you really don't want to get to this guy. And he would come out, and he did this for 40 days. He would yell to the Israelites, "Send out your own champion. Let's fight this thing out." And we look at this and we think, well, man, didn't they have somebody? You know? But something that we talked about with the Philistines is the Philistines were a very sophisticated culture. We think about the Philistines over here with their swords and the Israelites over here with their swords. No, the Israelites had no swords. Maybe a couple of them in the group. It was the day of the Iron Age that had begun, and the Philistines had that ability. And you read later on, we read later on about Jonathan and Saul. And it talks about them and that they didn't have the swords. They had to go down to the Philistines to get their farming implements sharpened, but they weren't going to tell them how to do it. Later on, David is going to be running from King Saul. Eventually, he's going to join up with the Philistines for a time being. He's kind of doing his own rebel thing for the Lord in this time. But guess what happens when David becomes king? They all of a sudden have iron. Wonder where David might have learned it. And there are many scholars that believe that the Iron Age for the Israelites came through that process, and David learning it there. But when David comes on the scene and he's the king, there's no problems with the Philistines. No more like we've been seeing. But just imagine, on one side you got all these soldiers, they've got all this armor. Over here you got a bunch of farmers with farming implements. Come on, bring out your best sharecropper. Take on Goliath. No. But there was a boy who showed up. And he heard Goliath one time and he had had enough of it. In fact, over in chapter 17, verse 26, David spoke to the men who were standing with him, "What will be done for the man who kills the Philistine and removes this disgrace from Israel? Just who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God?" And from then on, he was going to do his very dead level best to get in there and to take on Goliath himself if nobody's going to be man enough to do it among the army. And his brother started making fun of him. "You're too young. You're just trying to show us up." But you know what? David didn't listen to him because he knew it wasn't about him. It wasn't about his size. He didn't need size. He goes to King Saul and he says, "Listen, I can do this." And he says, "You know, I don't know." And then he starts giving him his resume. And really, David's the best he's got. And he said, "I've killed a lion and a bear." But listen to how he says it in verse 37. "Then David said, 'The Lord who rescued me from the paw of the lion and the paw of the bear will rescue me from the hand of the Philistines.'" It's God. All I need is God. And Saul said, "Put on my armor." Probably one of the few swords and you know, armor that they would have had. And he puts it on. It's way too big. Some scholars believe that he was as much as maybe even 6, 8, 10, 12 years of age. But you know what? He says, "I don't need armor. I need thee." And when he goes out to meet him, verse 45, David said to the Philistine, "You come against me with a dagger, spear, and sword, but I come against you in the name of the Lord of hosts. The God of Israel's army, you have defiled him. Today the Lord will hand you over to me. Today I'll strike you down, cut your head off, and give the corpses of the Philistine camp to the birds of the sky and the creatures of the earth. Then all the world will know that Israel has a God." I just need thee. "And this whole assembly will know that it is not by sword or by spear that the Lord saves. I need thee, for the battle is the Lord's. He will hand you over to us." And that's exactly what happened. Isn't that great? He knew it wasn't about his size. It wasn't about how much talent he has. In fact, he went out there with the only thing he really knew how to do. It's what shepherd boys do about 18 hours a day. They throw rocks. And it shows that when you do what you do, what God has blessed you to do, no matter how great it may be, no matter how small it may be, that when God's behind the rock, it will land and it will nail the giants in your life. You don't need a bigger weapon, you just need God. And so many times we sit here and we say to ourselves, "You know, if I just had this, if I had, you know, this skill, if I could have gone and gotten this degree, if I could have, you know, if in that particular instance," and we think about all these things, "if I had the advantages as this person over here." No, everybody who is a child of God has the same power behind it. I need thee. Every hour. Turn over to the book of 1 Kings chapter 17. Actually, chapter 18. 1 Kings chapter 18. I can't believe y'all don't have a clock in here for Dan. I go up to the hour, right? Right? 30 minutes after the hour? Okay. We're good. He said it, not me. I'm sorry. All right. Do what? Oh, he didn't say what hour. See there, you can always tell when preachers get together. Once heard a preacher, took his watch off. He said, "You know what that means, don't you?" He said, "Not a thing in the world." All right, 1 Kings chapter 18. Here's Elijah. We're down to the every hour part. Things had been bad in Israel. There was this beautiful couple who were running the country, the northern kingdom. You may have heard of them, Ahab and Jezebel. Jezebel. She had the 450 prophets of Baal eating at her own table. She was killing off the prophets of God. They had hid out, Obadiah had hid out 100 of those prophets and 50 other men. They were able to find them and they killed them, slaughtered them. And that's when God said, "It's time. that we deal with these false prophets of Baal. You take them up on Mount Carmel, we're going to have a fire calling ceremony. And they go up there and they take these two animals and they cut them and said, we're going to make our own altar. Said, you get to have everything you want in offering a sacrifice except matches. Your God's got to supply that. And said, tell you what, y'all go first. I love that. 450 prophets of Baal, 400 prophets of the Ashereth. And they start that morning and they start doing all the things that they do, calling on their gods, and guess what? Crickets. Just crickets. Nothing. Finally at noon, they had to step it up. And the Bible says they did a lame dance. And they started to cut themselves, hoping that their gods would feel sorry for them. And they started bleeding. Nothing. And what's really great, and we don't really have time to get into this, but you ought to go back and read it. Elijah talked smack to the prophets of Baal. And, you know, basically saying, won't you go wake him up? Maybe he can't hear you. You know, maybe he's going off on a journey. And one even instance in there, based upon the Hebrew there, is maybe he's going to the bathroom. Yeah, Elijah. Then he says, it's my turn. Took 12 rocks, stood for the 12 tribes of Israel, put that thing on there, said, dig a trench around this thing and now start pouring water. Just keep pouring it. Keep pouring it till it fills up this thing. 4 gallons of water filled up all around. This thing is drenched. And when he called on his God, the Bible says, oh, let's just read it. Let's just read it. Just got to figure out where to read it. Let's see. Okay, verse 38. Then Yahweh's fire fell and consumed the burnt offering, the wood, the stones, and the dust. And it licked up the water that was in the trench. When all the people saw it, they fell face down and said, Yahweh, He is God. Yahweh, He is God. And he said, go get those false prophets and bring them to me. And they took them down to this little creek type thing there, the Kishon River or whatever it's called, the Kishon, yeah, the Wadi Kishon. And he began to slaughter every one of them. Victory! God is there. Is this not spectacular? Can you imagine being there on that mountain and seeing all of this? Oh, Jezebel, she is going to turn and run. She's going to say, yes, there is only one God in Israel, and it is Jehovah God, right? No, it's not what happened. Listen to what she says in verse 2 of chapter 19. We skip over now. So Jezebel sent a message to Elijah saying, may the gods punish me and do so severely if I don't make your life like the life of one of them by this time tomorrow. And then something we see in Elijah we just didn't expect. Verse 3, then Elijah became afraid and immediately ran for his life. And he goes all the way down to Beersheba, which is 100 miles away south of Jezreel. He's scared to death of this woman. Elijah, do you remember the fire calling ceremony? But you know, it's like, that didn't do it. What else is it going to take? Now she's after me as well. But you know, God doesn't rebuke him. In fact, God sends an angel of the Lord on two different occasions to make sure when he got his sleep that he got food. The angel cooked him food right there and gave him fresh water. Said, you're going to need it because God says he wants you to meet him down at Mount Horeb, which is the mountain of God. It took him 40 days and 40 nights to get there. It's about a 250-mile trip. And he goes into a cave and he sleeps. And then God calls him. Watch this. This is one of my favorite passages in all of Scripture. And for a while, I didn't really know what it meant. And the more I studied it, the more I learned about it. Verse 11. Chapter 19. Then he said, go out and stand on the mountain in the Lord's presence. At that moment, the Lord passed by. A great and mighty wind was tearing at the mountains and was shattering cliffs before the Lord. But the Lord was not in the wind. After the wind, there was an earthquake, but the Lord was not in the earthquake. After the earthquake, there was fire. This has got to be it. This has got to be the Lord, right? Mount Carmel, fire coming down. This is God. But the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire, there was a voice, a soft whisper. When Elijah heard it, he wrapped his face in his mantle and went out and stood at the entrance of the cave. And suddenly a voice came to him, and for the second time God asked him this, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" How many times do we look for God in the wind? We look for Him in the earthquake. We look for Him in the fire. We look for Him in the extravagant. God, I saw You in the fire, but the next day the fire had already been put out. Now what? God, it just doesn't seem like You're there. You ever been there before, folks? You ever felt like God just isn't there? He's not answering your prayers? There's nothing spectacular. He's not taking this person out. He's not giving you that unbelievable job. He's not helping you in the way you think He ought to be helping you, in a great and miraculous way. God says, "Listen to my whisper." We get so busy. We keep looking for God in all these places. He says, "I've been there the whole time. And I'm doing things you just don't know what I'm doing." In fact, he goes on. In verse 15, "Then the Lord said to him, 'Go and return by the way you came to the wilderness of Damascus. When you arrive, you are to anoint Hazael as king over Aram. You are to anoint Jehu, son of Nimshi, as king over Israel, and Elisha, son of Shaphat, from Abel-Meholah, as prophet in your place. Then Jehu will put to death whoever escapes the sword of Hazael, and Elisha will put to death whoever escapes the sword of Jehu. But I will leave 7,000 in Israel, every knee that has not bowed to Baal, and every mouth that has not kissed him.'" You say, what does that mean? God says, "I've got something in motion." Two of the people that he just mentioned there and go to anoint aren't even born yet. There's only one, that's Elisha. He says, "You go and anoint him. He's going to take your place." And really, through proxy, he would anoint Jehu and Hazael. And he says, by the time that's all finished, he says, there will be no problem with Baal worship anymore. And you continue to read on in the Old Testament and through that history, and you learn it was exactly right. He took them out. But he says, "Listen, you just can't always hear me. I'm not always going to come down in fire. I need thee, Lord, every hour. I need you at my victories up on Mount Carmel, and I need you in the lowest depths when I feel like I'm on the run, when I feel like I'm hungry and thirsty, and I don't know what's going to happen. I need thee every hour." And God says, "I'm with you every hour. But don't expect me to have a fire calling ceremony every time you turn around." You know what I'm saying? Folks, I hope this helps you. I hope this really helps you. I hope this gives you strength, because our world is getting tougher and tougher at times. And for some, it's even worse than others. For some, it may be getting better. For some of you, you're on Mount Carmel. For some of you, you're down in the valley. But don't forget, God is there in both places.